Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 9th, 2011. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, we have two big guests lined up this evening. Paul Sadler, who's running for U.S. Senate from Texas, is going to be on with us here in about 10 minutes, about 7:10. And then in the second half hour, joining us for the umpteenth time, is Wendy Davis. Now, she was at the DNC convention because she's the new DNC member from Georgia, so this will be the first time she joins us as a member of the Democratic National Convention, so it'll be exciting to ask her about things regarding it as well, which she couldn't have answered before since she wasn't in that role. But we'll talk about all kind of the things as well. One thing that I saw that I just happened to see pieces here and there that I just wanted to get y'all's thought on real quick is it said that President Clinton's speech, at, you know, major points during the speech, outpaced NFL football, which was a really big surprise. But even a bigger surprise is something called Honey Boo Boo from Macon, Georgia, outpaced the president's speech and the NFL. I know people predicted the NFL would be the number one thing, and then maybe the President Clinton's speech, but then Honey Boo Boo, where did that come from? I'm not familiar with Honey Boo Boo other than what I've read in the AJC. I've never watched that program. Catherine, Tim, any ideas there?
I think it's like a child beauty pageant thing, and it also got more ratings than the Republican National Convention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This girl was first got famous on the internet, I believe on YouTube. She had a little YouTube video that had, I don't know, like 5 million viewers, and the producers of this show noticed it and contacted the family, and it's just the latest rage in reality shows. So a lot, you know how people love those reality shows, and with the shorter time of the conventions and all, a lot of people are tuning in to watch something like that. I'm really not surprised, to be honest.
Yeah, that is kind of surprising. Plus, it's on basic cable. And then another thing with the convention, I guess they take CNN, Fox, MSNBC, PBS, 2, 5, and 11, or the NBC, ABC. I guess they have to add all that together because, obviously, if you divided it so many different ways, you know, every show would outpace it just because it's play on every channel. But when you add it together, it's hard to believe that anything on one channel besides maybe NFL football would have a chance to outpace all of it added together. Well, this week, Peach Pundit, Charlie Harper did a series, I guess, he had to have published in the papers and on Peach Pundit about the future of the Democratic Party. I guess if we had this Honey Boo Boo character running in a good 20 years, but there'd be somebody with some popularity at this point, although I hope we don't have to wait 20 years. How about y'all?
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's funny. Charlie did that article, and, you know, we all respect Charlie's knowledge of Georgia politics, but it seems like that piece was missing something. It would have been a little better if it would have been Charlie and a Democrat giving their thoughts on the Democratic Party. Now, of course, I guess you could sell it as a outsider's look, if you will, because, I mean, a lot of it was on target. But, some of us that actually see these people in party situations might could say, hey, this person on the bench is not really doing as much as this other person on the bench, if you will, and other things it might be. Now, I guess Charlie would be as valuable in talking maybe about swing voters and that kind of thing. Tim, Catherine, I guess Catherine first, did you read P- pieces of the series?
I did, and I thought they were very thoughtful and even-toned. I was a little apprehensive when I heard about them. I was like, oh, no, he's going to really beat up on us. But I thought they were quite fair. You know, a few little jabs that maybe were unnecessary. I can't remember any of them right now, but I remember flinching a couple times. But I think he made a lot of good points, and I hope that someone who's got some influence is, sort of paying attention and taking, not using it as a playbook, but at least contemplating some of the things that he said, that he wrote.
Yeah, I know the one about the bench, I guess he didn't get is into the who is on the bench, if you will. It just says it needs additional time. Well, to me, I do think we have politicians that could be ready if the environment was right. I just don't want to waste some of them in the wrong environment, if you will. A lot of times, I'm sure probably any Georgia Democrat, Tim, would say that we wasted either Mark Taylor or Kathy Cox when they ran.
Yeah.
If you waited on one of them, you'd have the other one there.
Yeah, they mentioned also 2010 when Michael Thurman left what was a fairly safe place at the Labor Department and took that long shot campaign at the U.S. Senate against Johnny Isaacson in a race, especially in hindsight, that he had probably no chance at all in. So we've lost Tim Baker. We don't have any people in statewide office. I really do feel, however, that the big turning point you just mentioned was 2006. That just thinned our bench out terribly that year, and the Democratic Party really hasn't been the same since then. There was a huge split that year, and it just never has healed. He also talked about that Georgia Democrats need to learn to identify with Georgia voters on social issues. I don't necessarily agree with that, because I think when we come back statewide, probably the first statewide office we're going to win, in my book, will be the office of governor, and it's not going to be about social issues. It's going to be about people's pocketbook and Republican failures to deliver on some of the major issues facing this state right now. Wouldn't y'all agree with that?
I agree, and I don't think that that Democrats in Georgia are that. That was one of the comments he made was about the Chick-fil-A controversy, and I don't think that Georgia Democrats came out and suggested, as a body, suggested that we boycott Chick-fil-A. I mean, I think there were organizations that included people who are identified as Democrats, but I don't think as a body we came out for that. And I don't think we've been that outspoken about a lot of the social issues that seem to be, not as outspoken as I wish we were. So it's probably about right.
Yeah, I think obviously if a campaign led with a bunch of social issues, either way, I mean, there's a lot of Republicans like Pam Glanton back a few years ago that talked all about social issues. She didn't win lieutenant governor spot. If you lead with social issues either way, it's just going to narrow focus to the average middle-of-the-road voter. Well, let's go ahead and put this discussion on hold for a moment, because we got a call in from Texas, and we're going to talk to our first guest, Mr. Paul Sandler. Welcome, Mr. Sandler.
Sandler.
Hi. Sandler, I apologize. Catherine told me about doing that, and it got in my head. Well, Mr.
Okay.
Sandler, welcome to the combine.
Thank you.
Yes. Well, just first thing off, we've read a lot about you. We know a lot's been posted on places like Huffington Post and others about your experience, but some of our listeners may not be familiar. So go ahead and just tell us about your biography.
Sure. Thank you. I was first elected in 1991. I served until 2003. I stepped out of the legislature whenever my at the state legislature when my youngest son was involved in an accident. I chaired public education from 1995 until 2003. Some of the legislation that I passed included a mandate relief bill for public education or school districts that saved about $360 million for Texas. I co-authored the complete rewrite of the education code in Texas, three consecutive teacher pay raises, the largest property tax cut in the history of our state, including about $3 billion worth of school finance additional money. I passed for the first time in the history of the state of Texas an insurance program for public school employees. And for all of that, I was named a member of the 10 best legislators list by Texas Monthly four consecutive sessions, 95 through 2001. And so that's my background. I've chaired numerous committees. I'm the only person to ever chair two substantive committees in the same session, and I did it two sessions in a row, which included also a complete review of our tax code in Texas. So I have a pretty extensive legislative background, and that's what I'm trying to offer the voters in Texas.
Yeah, I'm a public school teacher, so if you want to come to a workshop here in Georgia about how to give pay increases, I hadn't had one in quite some time, I'd be much welcome. Well, let me understand this. It sounds like you served in Texas government longer than, say, George W. Bush did before he came to Washington. I mean, that's how long your experience is, correct?
That's correct. Actually, I started with Ann Richards back in 1991, went through George W. Bush, and then part of our current governor, Rick Perry.
So quite a while. And I guess some of that time was when Republicans started to kind of take over Texas. You were able to stay in office.
Yeah, we actually in the late, from the mid-90s on, we had pretty much a divided government. Whenever I served as chairman the latter half of my tenure, we had a House that was Democratic, dominated by about four votes, and a Democratic speaker, but we had a Republican-dominated Senate. And then, of course, we had a Republican governor. And so we had quite a bit of a divided government back then. We managed to get things done. We learned how to work together and accomplish things. And 2003, which is really very recent in the history of Texas, but in 2003, the Republicans took over both the House and the Senate and all statewide offices in Texas.
Yes. Well, I have a ton more questions for you, but I want to pass it around. But one more I want to ask you before I move on is, where was your district and, I guess, your home in Bastings? We know Texas has a lot of different population bases.
It does. It's a very diverse state, a very large state. We like to brag about that sometimes. But I'm from East Texas. The truth of the matter is I was born in South Texas, and lived from Freer to Corpus Christi, and then I lived out in West Texas. My father worked in the oil and gas industry. And then I moved up to Pampa, Texas, up in the Panhandle. I went to school at Baylor in Central Texas, and then the last 30 years I've lived in East Texas in the Tyler-Longview area. Basically, Tyler East of Shreveport is the district that I had, Tyler to the Louisiana border.
Okay. Well, I'll pass it around to Tim Schifflet, then to Catherine Smith.
Good evening, Mr. Sadler. Thank you for being with us.
Good evening.
Your opponent, Ted Cruz, has never held elective office, while you have a rather lengthy period of government service and experience to call upon. Is that proving to be an issue in this campaign?
Well, you know, it didn't when he ran in the Republican primary. In the Republican primary, he took on a three-term lieutenant governor in a July 31st election, which is an extraordinary time in Texas. I don't know if we've ever had an election in the middle of summer. When a very low turnout, then the Tea Party came out, and he won. Since then, I think a lot of people in Texas are starting to wake up and think, oh, my gosh, we've got the guy on the Republican side that has had no governmental experience whatsoever. And not only that, had some very reckless and radical ideas. And so as I go around the state and talk about it, people comment to me about wow, you know, you're really qualified. And I say, yeah, I've been here all along. there are people starting to wake up to that, and I hope it makes a difference. You know, the United States Senate is the highest legislative office, and some experience should be required. His only real experience is that he served as an appellate lawyer for the state for 5 years. And it's kind of interesting, you know, if you ask people in Texas what was the number one qualifier for a United States senator, I doubt you would find a single person that would say, be an appellate lawyer. I don't think that's the number one qualifier, but that's what he runs on.
Goodness. And also, I wanted to ask you one other thing before I swing it over to Catherine. Of course, in the last couple of weeks, Texas has made some huge national news with the state's voter ID law being basically thrown out, and also the federal courts once again throwing out the legislative drawn districts. What's your opinion on those things?
Well, I think both the federal courts are exactly right on both counts. The voter ID law that was passed in Texas is the sloppiest piece of legislation I've seen in a very, very long time. You know, they actually offered amendments, the Democrats actually offered amendments to try to make it comply with some other laws that have been passed around the country, and the Republicans voted that down and came up with this very, very strict rule. What I'm concerned about is there's a pattern in Texas, and particularly with this attorney general, where he I think he's trying to set up an appeal to the United States Supreme Court to challenge the entire Voting Rights Act, and particularly its application to Texas. And so I'm very much concerned about the direction in which it's going. But the federal court rulings were obviously directly, in my opinion, were correct. The voter ID provision particularly would have, according to the testimony, would have restricted or prevented, rather, between 4 to 6% of our voters. And that's an incredible, incredible thing. I mean, we're talking about 250,000 people not being able to vote.
Wow.
But,
I mean, that's enough people to easily swing any statewide election, isn't it?
I know. I was raised to believe that defending the right to vote was the patriotic thing, not restricting the right to vote. But for some reason, the Republican Party has decided this patriotic thing to eliminate people's right to vote. Now, we're talking about legally registered voters. We're talking about people that follow the laws, follow the rules, have voted for years, are entitled to vote, and they would exclude them now by changing the rules. And that's just not right. Not right in our state, and it's not right in this country.
Amen. And on that, I'm going to swing it over to Catherine. Catherine?
Thank you very much. Well, you know, we have that voter ID law here in Georgia, and it's been a real challenge to fight it. And more power to you. I hope you can, you know, build a good challenge, because it was tough for us and we never did succeed.
One of our fears, frankly, is the fact that we got so much publicity that we're afraid that some people will believe that it isn't in place anyway. In other words, they heard that it was passed and they didn't hear that it was thrown out. And so we're trying to get the word out to people that, you know, you have a legitimate right to vote. You are legally registered. You have a right to vote. Go vote. And, you know, we're hopeful that will occur.
Yeah, it's always hard to get the good news out if the bad news has gotten a lot of attention.
Right.
I always like to ask people about the state of the Democratic Party in any state that we're talking about. But I also want to sort of expand that question. I just read, and, you know, I read so many different things on the Internet. I can't remember where I read it. But I read an article that sort of suggested that there was a lot of optimism on a lot more Democrats getting elected in Texas in the coming years, and wonder what you think about that, and also what the state of your party is and how that may affect the coming blue, you know, making Texas blue, as we all seem to like to say.
Sure. I'm very excited about what's happening with the Texas Democratic Party. We have a very dynamic and strong new chairman that was just elected, Gilberto Hinojosa. As I've traveled around this state and I've been border to border, it's over, you know, I've been over 5,000 miles in the last 5 weeks, and it's just a big, big state. But there are regions in our state that are definitely Democratic, from basically El Paso all the way down to the Gulf Coast. There are also regions in our, I mean, there are parts of our urbans, Dallas County, Austin, San Antonio are Democratic and have voted Democratic. Houston should, Harris County should come through. Those are our major metropolitan areas. There's a lot of activity throughout the state for the Democratic Party. There are county chairs and county organizations throughout. And so there's a lot to be proud of and a lot to be positive about. The demographics of our state are definitely trending Democratic. In fact, if everyone would actually vote, the state would be Democratic without a doubt.
Yeah, that was one of the shocking things I read, was it like, what is it, like 38% of the population is Latino, but only 20% of those people vote. And
right.
The belief is if you could just up that by 10 more points, you'd probably see a lot of
better performance. Yeah, all the statewide candidates would win if we had a 10% greater Hispanic turnout. But it's really a matter of the state, the entire state lifting up. There are working people that have voted Democrat their whole lives for the last decade, and they just need to come home and understand that it's the Democratic Party that represents the working family. And things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, these are programs that need to be preserved. They're safety net issues that benefit all of us in Texas, and so it's not merely one demographic. It's everyone in Texas should really, really come back. Now, I will say this, that I think that there is optimism that in future years Texas will vote Democratic, but there's no reason why it shouldn't happen this year. The problem we are having is that we end up running in a statewide campaign against disbelief. You end up not having to run so much against Mr. Cruz. I mean, he's crazy enough, and he's created enough issues that a sane person with qualifications shouldn't be elected. The problem is that no one seems to believe it, and they don't believe it in the National Party, and you don't read it, you don't hear it in the media. The media is stuck on this fact that, well, a Democrat can't win in Texas, or it's only a Republican state, and it's simply not true. And it ends up being a horrible catch-22, because no one will invest money into our state, which allows us to turn out the vote, but then they all wring their hands and say, why aren't you Democratic? And so we've shipped out of our state. The last count I saw, which was 4 months ago, and it's much higher than that now, over $12 million to out-of-state candidates.
Right.
The
same thing happens in Georgia. We're like a giant ATM.
That's right. We may be approaching $20 million now being sent out of state.
Wow.
And in a federal race like mine, that's very troublesome, because when the National Party comes in and does that, you cap your major donors. You cap them through individual contributions and annual contributions. And then when you have a fluke happen, like happened on July 31st, where you have a guy who's not qualified, who's never been elected to anything, sweep in through a Tea Party, and you want to mount a challenge against them, you can't raise the money, sufficient money to run in Texas. To give your listeners some idea of the cost associated with it, to run statewide television in Texas is $1.3 million per week. So to do four weeks, just the last month of the election costs $5.2 million. Now, $2,500 a pop. That's over 2,000 people that have to donate $2,500. Those folks, most of them are capped already. And so they've created, because of a strategy that was put in place some time ago, we've created a real problem in the state raising funds for not only congressional candidates, but for my race in the United States Senate. And if the National Party then won't turn around and invest in the state of Texas, it's really disingenuous to say, well, Texas won't vote Democratic. No, we won't if you don't invest money here, and if we don't as donors keep our money here, and get the voter out and do GOTV programs, and allow our candidates to get up on TV. It's virtually impossible to win without it. And so it's very frustrating. You know, I'll just tell you, in the last 7 days, my schedule has gone from East Texas to Dallas, back through Central Texas. And it's gone, I'm just going to call out the names so you'll know. I've gone from Henderson to Carthage to Marshall to Tyler to Dallas to Terrell, Athens, Jacksonville, back to Tyler, back to Dallas, Williamson County, Austin, Seguin, San Antonio. And in the morning, I leave to go to Brady, San Angelo, Midland, Odessa, Sweetwater, Abilene, Weatherford, Fort Worth. Now, that trek alone is well over 1,000 miles.
Wow.
Okay. And so it's just a very big state. It's not like, well, it's just not, I don't think some people understand the breadth of it. And so it is very frustrating to be the most qualified candidate, to be the only candidate really qualified, to have a perfect message. I mean, we are so right on these issues and they are so wrong. And not be able to get the message out to the voters in Texas because our money's being shipped out of state. And that's really unfortunate.
Yes, it is really unfortunate. And I hope your new party here will try to work on that. We had some here in Georgia asking, I don't know exactly how it works or if it's working at all, but we were very concerned about the same thing. And our party leadership to the DNC and said, hey, when you come in here, when, you know, President Obama flies in here in 5 hours, raises, you know, $4 million.
Right.
And they said, when you do that, can't we just have a little bit of it?
Yeah.
And there was some noise about how they, you know, there was some, you know, plan to, I don't, and like I said, I'm not connected with the party, so I don't know what, if that ever worked out, but I think that's a legitimate request. You know, you come in here, you get, you know, we are, I'm sure Houston, Dallas, San Antonio are giant ATMs for the president and for other candidates as well. You know, they fly in, they hit three or four parties and, you know, walk away with, you know, $1, 2, 3, 4 million.
Well, yeah, we've had the president in our state 3 times. Biden's been here twice. Pelosi, Reid, there have been 3 different fundraising circuits, more than one event, for at least 5 out-of-state United States senators.
Right.
And when the Dallas Morning News runs a story on me and my bid to run for the United States Senate, and they call the DSCC and ask, does Sadler have a chance to win? The response was no comment.
No, yeah, that's not right.
No, at some point, that's just not right. And you can't come down and take all the money out of here and then not even respond to the press. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't want to complain, and I'm not whining about it. I'm going to run this race as hard as I can, and I hope I'm going to win. I should win. But it's awfully hard to run without money. And when you're taking all the money out and then you get an inquiry from the press, you could at least say, well, he's got a shot.
Well, at least you could say he's the most qualified, and we sure will hope he wins, you know? I've taken up enough time. I'm going to pass it back to David. Thank you so much for your comment.
You bet. Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Sadler, you mentioned on your issues about developing alternative renewable energy resources. And, of course, you mentioned your past background with your family in oil and gas. We know
right.
that if there's any state in the nation that oil is still important to, it's Texas. But then you got people like Boone Pickens from Texas that looks at this, too. In Texas, how does this sell the dynamics between old energy and new energy?
You know, Texas leads the country in production of wind energy. And in fact, because of Texas, the United States is, I think, number 2 in the world in production of wind energy. We are multiple times the production of any other state in the United States. You know, I worked in that area the last 5 years, from Texas all the way up through Nebraska, including Kansas and Oklahoma and the legislatures and governors of all those states. We have a tremendous resource that blows from central Texas all the way up through Canada. Of a tremendous resource along our coast. And actually, one of the things, the very good things that the legislature has done in Texas is create a program to build out transmission lines to bring more wind energy online. We are an oil and gas state. Oil and gas is going to be king for a long time, but we're also the leading producer of wind energy. And they work together, and they can work together. You know, Mr. Pickens' program, he began by spending about $60 million nationwide on TV talking about wind energy, but he never actually built the program in Texas. In fact, mostly now he talks about natural gas because we've had such an explosion of natural gas through this state as well. But the fact is that Texas happens to be blessed with multiple energy sources. We have tremendous demand because of the construction of our state, the demographics of our state. We have the I-35 corridor where you have five cities approaching 1 million people each. And so we have not only the resource but demand, and we have a grid system that's solely contained within our state, which means we move much faster than any other program in the country. And so we have developed the rules. We have developed the wind energy, and we're building transmission lines to get it into our city centers. And so it's really an exciting prospect here in Texas, but like every other program in the country involving wind energy, the failure of the Congress to enact the production tax credit is going to hurt the industry. And I get sick and tired of listening to people talk about how highly subsidized wind is, when the fact of the matter is that 99.9% of the subsidies in the state of Texas go to oil and gas, and over 60% of the subsidies from Washington go to oil and gas and fossil fuels. The subsidies for wind are almost negligible in comparison, but it does help balance the playing field somewhat. And so I'm all for us producing oil and gas and producing natural gas and all generation sources, but this is a clean alternative. It helps us with pollution of our air. To give you some idea, when we complete the build-out of the transmission lines to West Texas for wind energy in Texas, we will save $17 billion, that's with a B, 17 billion gallons of water a year.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the top 8 feet of Lake Travis that supports Austin. That's the top 4 feet of Lake Texoma that supports Dallas-Fort Worth. That's every single year in a state that is hungry for water because of drought. And so there are huge benefits, not only cost savings, environmental benefits, but there are also very practical water resource benefits as well in the state. And so at the same time that we're drilling for natural gas like crazy and fracking shale gas and using over 1 million gallons of water per well to produce that fracking and water that can never be used again, it seems to me to make some sense that we ought to be doing alternative energy as well, at least to offset and save as much water as we can. It just seems to make common sense to me, and I think it does to most Texans as well.
Yes, I'm sure the average person doesn't even put together natural gas and water usage even being tied together. So that's a great point you brought up. Well, kind of a final question we always like to ask of our candidate guest. If somebody's heard you tonight and they want to support your campaign, what are some ways they can do that?
SadlerForSenate.com. There's a website, SadlerForSenate.com. There's a way to check out everything, volunteer. You can even donate online. There's an address and phone number as well. I would appreciate the help of anyone that's willing to answer the call. We're going to be fighting hard, and I promise you we can win this state. I've run in East Texas. If you combine East Texas with South Texas, you win the state. If I can get over 40% of the vote, just over 40% of the vote in East Texas, I should be the next United States Senator of Texas. The last time I ran in the top half of that portion for state Senate in a predominantly Republican-drawn district, which was 60% Republican, I won 14 out of the 16 counties, got 49% of the vote. If I can duplicate that result, I'll win by 5 points. And so it's not a matter of we can't do it. It's a matter of getting people to believe. And so any help that you can give me, I would certainly appreciate.
Yes, we hope people have heard you and want to support your campaign, because I really think that Texas is a very intriguing state that if people put work into it, it can turn faster than people predicted. Maybe running solid candidates like yourself will help it happen sooner than later.
It only takes one race. We win one race and everything will change. I promise.
Amen.
Yes. Well, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Sadler.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sadler.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Paul Sadler, U.S. Senate candidate from Texas. And really, I mean, I'm actually mean that. If you start ranking these races, now, of course, Virginia and now Missouri, states like that are going to get a ton of attention. But when you start ranking under those hot two or three races, there's a lot of states that kind of fall into a pile. And I think then you start looking at how does the challenger look, how does the Republican candidate look. And I think Mr. Sadler, with his experience, ranks up a little higher than some of our other Democrats in other states. And then, of course, Ted Cruz being such a Tea Partier. It just makes Texas move up that list. And oftentimes we do Southern power rankings, if you will, and that's probably that race has helped it some. But if we start ranking Senate races, we'd have to rank it higher than a lot of them. Well, like I said, tonight was a two-guest show. And now we're ready for our second guest, fresh off of coming from Charlotte and the Democratic National Convention. Welcome back, Wendy Davis.
Good evening, y'all. How are you?
Yeah. Well, I take it you made it safely back from Charlotte, correct?
Well, I'm still on the last half of my trip. We took a little detour over to Asheville to, unfortunately, watch the Rome Braves not be successful in the first round of the playoffs, but we had a lot of fun over in Asheville cheering them on.
Well, that's good to hear. Well, Wendy, you were at the convention. We obviously watched probably most of us more than bits and pieces. What did you see that we wouldn't have seen on TV?
Well, goodness, each of the nights started around 5 o'clock with speeches, and they were almost nonstop, pretty much back to back. So most people just saw the prime time speeches, and they missed a lot of good stuff. But part of our problem with perspective when we're there is it just starts going and we get into it. Somebody made a great analogy, said it was like a several-day rock concert, you know, and you're like, oh, wait, oh, I love this band. Oh, I love that song. And then the next person comes up and it's like, oh, this is my favorite too. And or I've never heard of this person, but wow, I really like that tune, you know. So it was great. Excitement. If I've got one thing to say about the speeches you may have missed, is go back and look at any of the governors or former governors. There was not a flat note among them. In particular, Governor Granholm from Michigan, I believe she was in prime time Thursday night. She was sure fired up and gave one heck of a speech about the saving of the auto industry that President Obama deservedly takes a lot of credit for.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned her. Of course, Drudge Report took still photos of that speech and said, you know, that she went crazy. And if you look at the photos, they do look kind of strange. I thought, well, let me be fair and see them in context. And then you actually see the speech, and the speech doesn't match up with the photos, the still photos. And so you can tell Drudge was, once again, not playing fair. But then as I'm watching the content of that speech, she mentions how many auto industry jobs were saved. And, of course, the Republicans and Democratic Party go back and forth on how many jobs are created. And that seems like a figure that the Democratic Party needs to get out there. How many jobs have been saved by the stimulus package, by the auto industry bailout? Because you have the sense that it's in the millions, and if it's
those
number ought to be one that just rolls off of Democratic tongues. Wendy?
Right. Those numbers were enormous. I mean, and she was just, again, she broke some of the cardinal rules of what, you know, all those, messaging gurus tell you about your gestures, don't get too wild. And she fell victim to it, like you said, what Drudge did to her. But I tell you what, she was – you know, she was in the moment and she was very passionate. And yes, she was gesticulating wildly, but it worked. You know, it worked in the moment. It worked in the time, and it got the place fired up. And that was her job. But those numbers are critically important. We need to all get them down because it's an important part of the story of the last 4 years.
Yeah, I did a Google search, and I did not see it. That's not saying that it just wasn't the, you know, correct little wording or what have you, and it's really out there. But it seems like something they need to work on because, I mean, that's, I think a lot of swing voters, if you will, would understand that, you know, Bush created a mess. It was tougher to clean it up than we thought. But if we would have gone this other plan, this many more jobs would have been lost.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's worth arguing that point if that number gets put together. And since you now are on the DNC, you might be empowered to tell somebody that can tell somebody else and finally get that figure calculated. Wendy, I'm probably going
Go ahead.
I was going to pass it around, but you're going to make a response or a point, so make it.
Yeah, actually, one of the things after the DNC meeting on Friday – the Georgia delegation, we all sort of put our heads together and have assigned each other tasks to put together a good mailing out to the state committee that captures a lot of this information because we want to make sure that what happens up there doesn't stay up there, you know, that we're bringing it back home and giving that enthusiasm and that good information to all our members.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it over, Wendy, to Tim. And, Catherine, I don't know if your phone is doing the thing it does sometimes. I'm not in front of the switchboard to test it out. But, yeah, and there you go. Got better. That's good. Tim, what are some questions for Wendy?
Well, good evening, Wendy, and congratulations, by the way, on being our newest DNC member.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honored to have the role.
And that echo is bad.
I'll call back.
Okay.
But in any way, you know, no one, I don't think, was surprised that Bill Clinton gave a stem-winding speech. But were you a little bit surprised that we got some stem-winding speeches from some, shall we say, unusual sources like Debbie Patrick or John Kerry, for instance?
Oh, my goodness. I was so... The biggest surprises on Thursday night was how passionate John Kerry was, and we were all sitting there looking at each other going, why didn't this John Kerry show up when he was our nominee? We were so disappointed that it took him so long to figure out how to give a good speech. And then the other contrast on Thursday night was Joe Biden. You know, you expect Joe Biden to be the pounding on the podium kind of guy, and there were parts of that speech that he was almost whispering. I mean, it was amazing that arena filled with so many thousands of people was quiet enough for him to speak so softly. I thought it was very powerful and, again, very uncharacteristic of the person giving the speech. So those were the kind of the surprises for me in terms of where my expectations were.
Yeah, well, now, many of the pundits, a lot of the talking heads, thought that the president's speech, compared to some of the others, was, I don't know, a little bit flat. How did it play in the arena?
Oh, well, there was nothing flat about the president's speech in that arena. Now, again, we might, I mean, it was hard to say that it was, quote-unquote, better than Bill Clinton's, but he hit the marks he needed to hit. He stirred people up. He was, you know, passionate and thoughtful, and I think made his case very well. And it certainly, there wasn't anybody leaving that arena disappointed Thursday night.
Okay, one more question, then I'm going to throw it over to Catherine. We heard a lot on television and the internet about how big a deal the cancellation of the closing night
outside was. How big a deal was that actually there?
Oh, well, I mean, it was heartbreaking in a lot of ways because we had the unusual opportunity to expand the number of people who could enjoy that last night of the convention, you know, and that was so exciting. And, you know, I personally, I had over a dozen people who were coming from Rome who normally wouldn't, you know, they're not people who would have ever necessarily been delegates, you know, but they had the opportunity and the flexibility in their schedule. And I had to call them Wednesday morning and tell them not to come. And it was, you know, I was lucky that they all understood and, you know, weren't, I mean, they were upset, but they weren't, you know, they weren't mad. They didn't take it badly. But one of the guys, I couldn't catch him before he had gotten, he was taking a bus to Charlotte, and he was already in South Carolina. So the poor thing, he rode on a bus all the way to Charlotte to, you know, struggle to get to his hotel because of all the security measures, and then has to, you know, watch it in his hotel room and, you know, go home the next day. And so that was disappointing, but it was the right decision to make. You know, it did end up pouring down rain, and a lot of people got drenched coming. But again, part of what President Obama has brought to the party is a level of openness and inclusion that we didn't necessarily see before. He started it 4 years ago by having the larger space for the closing night speech in Denver. And it is a great idea. And the campaign says they're going to make it up to the people who had those, what they were called, those tickets were called community credentials, and that they're going to, when the president is in their state, make sure they get a special invitation to get to see the president and to try to make it up to him. And the president did do a conference call Thursday, you know, midday, that all those folks were invited to participate in, and offered his apologies, and, you know, the head of his campaign apologized profusely. I mean, and it's, you know, it is what it is. It's not what anybody wanted, and gives us a lot to think about as we try to select our convention location for 2016.
I want to ask
a follow-up real quick, and then you can go back and we'll pass it to Catherine. Wendy, is that just not more impetus for both the Democratic and the Republican conventions to be held in cities with domes or retractable roof stadiums for the whole convention, not just the fourth night or the third night, they're saying, in the future? Why shouldn't they just go to places like Atlanta, Indianapolis, Phoenix, where you have the ability to close that roof down irregardless of the weather?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's something that will be heavily factored in future decisions. And, you know, and now that I'm on the DNC, I'll have a better sense of how that decision-making process goes. So, you know, there are a lot of different factors that weigh into it, the availability of hotel space and how convenient things are to foot traffic, that kind of thing. So, you know, again, that's something that will certainly be a heavy factor down the road.
Well, Wendy, what about this rumor, mainly put forth by the opposition party, that the only reason the outside event was canceled was because there was no chance that the Democrats could fill the seats?
That's ridiculous. The people were still, even with the what was an expanded number with the community credentials, people were still there clamoring for them when they had all been passed out, right? Earlier in the week, people were like scrounging and scratching and trying to get their hands on them. That place was going to be packed. It was going to be packed, no doubt in my mind.
Okay, and on that happy note, we'll swing her over to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, Wendy, how's it going? Are you?
I'm going very well, Catherine.
Looking forward to being home, I'm sure.
You know, I love to travel, but it's not going to hurt my feelings to be in my own bed tonight, that's for sure.
Well, I always like to ask, you know, whenever any of my friends go on vacation, I always ask, what was the high point?
Well, I mean, to be frank, I have to say it is President Clinton's speech. I mean, I always feel smarter having listened to him and feel like he nails so many things in such a simple way that we should all be able to go out and communicate that message. And so, I mean, that was definitely the high point, but of a lot of highs. Again, it was like just an amazing concert with all your favorite songs and and new favorite songs. You know, it was just, there was a lot to be excited about.
I do like that. I do like that analogy. I think it's excellent for those of us who have had that experience. I think that's an excellent analogy.
Well, the fun thing that you don't think about, too, is like we, Thursday night, they were talking about that they were going to have to shut down the arena at some point, and they were warning everybody to get in early. So, and we also wanted to miss the rain, so we went really stinking early, and we're kind of just sitting around. And it was kind of fun because, like, we got to hear Mark Anthony rehearse singing the national anthem. And I have to tell you that the TV audience got the best version of the three he sang. So.
Well, I also always like to know about celebrity sightings. So who did you see?
Because I wasn't an actual delegate this time. I was a special guest, so I was up in the rafters. So I didn't quite get as many sort of close encounters as I previously had, but I went to some of the events during the day, and I think one of the people I was most excited to see, who I had never had the chance to see before, was the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And it was really, and I got a picture taken with him and had a chance to thank him for the great work he's doing. And what was interesting was it was for the Veterans and Military Families Council of the DNC, and he actually wasn't on the panel to speak, but came to the room because of his obvious interest in the topic and was literally like standing at the back of the room just listening to what was going on. So, but it was a great honor to meet him, and I really do think they're doing an amazing job transforming the VA, especially with all the obstacles they're facing with so many returning veterans with such obvious wounds.
Yes, and I think we can thank the First Lady, and I guess, do we call her the Second Lady?
The Second Lady, yes. Or Dr. Jill, right? Isn't that what we call her?
Dr. Jill, right?
Or Jilly, if you're Joe in a moment there.
Well, I have to say that, I watched most of it. I watched it on C-SPAN, so I could watch it pretty much gavel to gavel as soon as I got home from work. And I have to say that... I also really enjoyed President Clinton's speech. I thought that President Obama's speech was very good. I thought he started off kind of slow, but I really enjoyed the way he sort of built the tension and the passion in his delivery. And I don't know if that was intentional or if it was just the way it worked out for him. But I thought that was very compelling. But I thought the thing that was most moving to me, and I'm sure it was even more moving to those of you who are in the arena, was when Gabby Giffords gave the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, you cannot imagine. I mean, you can't imagine because you saw it. But the emotion that was just everywhere. And the thing that got me was we were very confused because, again, when the evening started at, approximately 5, and they did, again, Mark Anthony sang the national anthem, and they did a presentation of colors before that, and we were all kind of like, where's the Pledge of Allegiance? Because you usually do the Pledge of Allegiance, right when you're doing the national anthem at the beginning of things. And so, and then later somebody sent me an article that said that former Congresswoman Giffords was supposed to do the Pledge of Allegiance, and I was like, oh, my God, did something happen? Like, is she sick? Or, I was just like, I thought we had missed it, and it just didn't occur to me that, they were going to wait until prime time to bring that powerful piece out. And then when we saw them, I can't remember now if I saw her coming out or I heard them saying the pledge first, but it was just, the whole place was in a lot of ways caught by surprise, and so that even added to the power. Again, words can hardly describe the emotion of that, and just her courage and strength. Again, it makes me speechless, and y'all know how hard that is. But it was very, very powerful. Very, very powerful.
Thank you so much, Wendy, for presenting us there, presenting for us there, and for coming on tonight and talking with us. So now I'm going to pass it back to David.
Yeah, Wendy, if you got speechless real easy, we'd quit inviting you on the show, so we know that's not true. Wendy, I didn't realize you sat in the upper rafters, if you will, in the upper deck of the Bobcats Arena there. Now, was there special Georgia seating for you like there was 8 years ago? Not for you, but for some Georgia guest?
No, actually. Basically, it was, you know, fend for yourself. And I didn't go early enough Tuesday or Wednesday. So, I mean, like Tuesday in particular, I was like, you know, scared walking up the steps because I was walking so high, scared I was going to fall over. And but the Thursday night, again, like I said, we went really early. So we had the best of those nosebleed seats. But again, I couldn't complain. We were there in the arena and so many people weren't. And I was just honored again to be able to be there. And I'm looking forward to the fun of being a super delegate next time.
Yeah, well, Wendy, I guess you don't remember that in 2008, I won't incriminate the others, but Georgia was the only of the 50 states to have designated upper-level seating made that day at the Boston Kinko's. I think that was on night three and night four. That'll be another story for another time when things are slower. But I will admit I was involved in that. Involved in that on the air. Well, Wendy, we know that you're privy, I guess, to some information you may can share, but I'm going to try to get one thing that you can share. Now, obviously, when we know they're going to put a lot of money in the presidential race in Ohio and Florida, and they're going to put a lot of money in a Tim Kaine's race in Virginia. What's the one place that they may be targeting that they let y'all know at the DNC that might surprise us?
Well, what might surprise you is the DNC meeting on Friday morning was beyond anticlimactic because of everybody involved in the leadership of that meeting on Friday had been involved in everything that was going on during the convention. And so basically the convention was the meeting, right? And so Friday's meeting was very perfunctory and none of those juicy details were shared. The financial report was, we have a lot of money coming in. We have small donors, not big, you know, $10 million check writers, and we're spending the money thoughtfully and strategically. Have a nice day. And I have been assured that future meetings will have more details and more discussion and more opportunity for input. But that's kind of just a, you know, a tie up the loose ends meeting at the end of a very busy, tiring convention week. So,
okay.
Sorry, I don't have the scoop.
That's okay. See, Wendy, you could have lied to us since we probably have a lot of Texas listeners that they're going to put a lot of money in Mr. Sadler's race.
I tell you what, Mr. Sadler had enthusiastic supporters among the Texas delegation. I saw his name almost every time I turned around from people from Texas. They were wearing his T-shirts, wearing his stickers, and they are very enthusiastic about his campaign. And you all know as well as I do, you know, the only thing that can match the kind of money that's going to be pouring in there is the legwork and the real passion of volunteers and activists reaching out to their neighbors and knocking doors and making those phone calls. And I feel like we've got a shot anywhere. We've got enthusiastic people ready to go.
Yeah, I noticed since the convention, it looks like the President Obama definitely got more of a bounce than Mitt Romney did. I mean, right now, just your best guess, would it kind of be the where we would win pretty much every state we won last time except for Indiana, in particular North Carolina, since you were in that state? What does it look like in North Carolina?
Well, I think North Carolina is still neck and neck, but again, I think the enthusiasm that was generated from this past week in North Carolina won't dissipate easily. And importantly, the Obama team, we all know that they did a lot of creative, cutting-edge things in terms of organizing 4 and 5 years ago, and they haven't forgotten those tricks, and they now have contact information literally for tens of thousands of people in North Carolina to get them engaged in the campaign, and I think that is going to make an enormous difference and be able to hold North Carolina for the president. But it's going to be close. It's going to be close a lot of places, frankly, a lot of places where it shouldn't be. But if you look at their week in Tampa and our week in North Carolina, we did a much better job of bringing home a clear message that I think will reach a lot of those, quote, swing voters and really move us further. I think that's why we've got a bounce and they didn't. And I'm really pleased with how the week went.
Yeah, I guess the biggest letdown for us is we didn't take any one piece of furniture and raise their profile to unseen levels as they did at the GOP convention.
Oh,
I mean,
my
I was hoping
we'd
take a special table or bookshelf and do that, but, you know, the GOP has that. You know, maybe they can open a furniture store. I don't know. Clint Eastwood, apparently he just had the idea, we learned this week, on the spot.
Yeah, well, thankfully we weren't that lucky. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Wendy, we have taken you right up into recorded time, if you will, so that tells us it's probably about time to go. Anything else you need to share before we close this thing down?
No, let me just say that I, am excited about my opportunity serving on the Democratic National Committee and would love to, you know, after we have our meetings, I'm pretty sure they're quarterly, to report back here to your audience in addition to reporting back to the state committee and the county chairs in Georgia and keep you all abreast of what we're doing.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely call on you because, what is that, a two-year or four-year term?
Four-year term. Mm-hmm.
Four-year term, so you've got 4 years we'll be bugging you.
Yeah, go through the convention in 16, so.
Yep. Okay, well, thanks again, Wendy.
Thanks, Wendy.
A lot. Y'all have a good time talking to you. All right, take care.
Yes, well, big night tonight. Paul Sadler, I'm telling you, if people hear more and more about this guy, they're going to like him and realize. And then Wendy Davis, for I don't know how many times she's been on, and like she just promised us now, will be on many times in the future. But this has been the Kudzu Vine. Good evening, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that.